Now to the subject of reforming the criminal justice system. The city of Seattle has taken action to limit the impact of court fees on people who don't have a lot of money, and now there's a new lawsuit to take similar actions nationwide. Here's the report from Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
There's a growing movement across the nation to limit or stop charging many court fines and fees now seen as barriers to people moving forward. Seattle Municipal Court judges have discretion to waive certain fees and fines, and they often do. But last month, they unanimously voted to stop charging fees for things like probation, community service, and work release programs that had been the norm.
These fines and fees are essentially a hardship on the back of people of color, especially black people.
And presiding judge Willie Gregory says there's no correlation with paying those fines and improved outcomes.
And really, there's really not a whole lot of connection to those people being, for example, placed on probation and then paying a $25 a month fee, or doing community service and paying $25 for community service.
Instead, he says they can often be barriers to moving forward. So the goal is to help stop that.
What we're really shooting for is fairness and equity, that when a person comes in here, they can take care of their case and not worried about leaving here with fines and fees and everything else too, and worried about that more so than worried about getting healthy.
This is one of several changes the court has made recently, including a new pretrial diversion program that connects low-level offenders with social services. The court's Lori Bett says they've learned a lot about what works better during COVID.
We're communicating with our clients through Skype calls. We're talking on the cell phone. We're emailing back and forth. I mean, it's using that as a whole combination. So if we can break down interruptions to things that are helping be a stabilizing influence for people, that's one of the things that we're doing. You know, there's always things that are barriers for each individual. It could be chronic substance abuse issues. It could be chronic unemployment. It's just lots of things. That's why we really want to work individually with each person on what it is that their presenting needs are. If we can partner with someone to help break the cycle of them returning to court, it makes the community safer as well as assisting that individual.
Seattle's probation fees were $25 a month and often totaled as much as $600, while things like work crew fees and community service fees were $25 each. There's also record check fees that could be as high as $240 a month. All of that can add up and deter people from even showing up to court and really stop them from getting their lives on track. Judge Gregory says that's just not the way they want to do things.
And so I think what this does is this, number one, shows that we are serious about doing what we can to prevent and address systemic racism. And I know if I was a person coming to the courthouse knowing that the court is eliminating fines and fees that I could have on me so I can pay attention to my case and get healthy, if a person is going to be convicted of a crime, they can look at that and say, at least these judges are looking at me as a person. And these judges are taking equity and justice seriously.
There have been similar efforts in Olympia for the past several years when it comes to court fees and fines associated with traffic violations, but they continue to fail. That's why the ACLU filed a lawsuit this week against the State Department of Licensing, claiming unpaid traffic ticket fines that lead to licenses being suspended is a violation of the state constitution.
What happens for a lot of people is they get the ticket, they can't afford it, it goes in the glove box, maybe they didn't see it come in the mail. Their license gets suspended. They still need to drive. They need to drive to work, to take their kids to school. And they get pulled over and they get charged with the crime of driving while license suspended in the third degree. It's a misdemeanor and it's the most commonly charged crime in the state of Washington. People can get arrested. They can go to jail.
The ACLU's Lisa Nowlin.
And what we see happening is that the fines just really snowball, right? So not just from the ticket itself, which has, you know, interest added on, fees, collection costs, but now these additional tickets and arrests for driving while license suspended. And so it's very easy to owe, you know, $10,000, $20,000 just because you were too poor to pay the ticket in the first place.
And that doesn't help anybody get headed in the right direction. Regardless of what happens with the lawsuit, the legislature will still have to act. And the hope is that the legal action can maybe help move that along.
And Hannah Scott joins us live. Now, I just heard in that clip she's saying this is terrible because we're piling on people who are just too poor to be able to follow the law. That's not entirely true. The way to avoid a high fine is not to speed, right?
Well, yeah, and it can be, you know, it doesn't always have to be a speeding ticket. It can be a variety of moving violations. But sure, you know, in an ideal world, that would be fine. And maybe you're going 7 miles over the speed limit. Or it just, there's a lot of variables when we're talking about a speeding ticket. I understand a bit what she's talking about. Many, many years ago, when I was a very young driver, I had this similar issue. And I was afraid to go to court. And they spiraled out of control in California. By the time I went, I had like $10,000 in fines. But I went to court and the judge gave me a payment plan, you know, knocked a lot of that off, but it's something that you're afraid of, right? I mean, as a young person, I was afraid of it, but if you're, you know, a single mom with one of their clients is a single mom just trying to go to work, you got to take your kid to daycare, you have to go to your job, you go and you drive on this suspended license, and it's terrifying because then you can go to jail if you get arrested for that. And if you're somebody who makes, you know, minimum wage and you have to pay rent somewhere here in this state, how are you going to, you know, deal with this $12,000, $15,000 thing that's accumulated? So sure, not speeding at the beginning would be great, but that's just not the reality, I think.
You guys strike a balance, though. You can't say, okay, I'm too poor to be expected to follow the rules, right?
No, and I don't think that is what the case is. I think that they're saying that it's mandatory, the suspension of license and all of these fines if you don't pay your traffic ticket. That's more the issue. I don't think it's saying that, you know, these people get away with speeding and these people do not. Just that it's seen as a barrier. And overall, in the larger conversation, this disproportionately affects low-income people of color, and is just one of many other barriers that keeps them from succeeding. So I think that's the argument.
Well, it's true that set fines definitely disproportionately affect poor people, but suppose we handle it like they do in some European countries where your fine is not a set amount. It's a proportion. It's keyed to your income. So if a billionaire speeds, he might get charged $100,000, and if a poor person speeds, it might be, you know, 25 or whatever.
Sure, and there is that. There is that definite ability for individual judges to make that type of call. The mandatory part of this is the suspension of a license if you don't pay this ticket. But if you, again, if you're in that scenario, you're low income and you need your car, you don't want, you have to do what you have to do, and you're not going to be able to have that money to even make a payment plan maybe. You just go on and do things as normal. You drive, and then as soon as you get caught, you're going to make everything worse. So this is, I believe she said that in Oregon, they've outlawed this, and I do know I've followed this a little bit in the legislature. There have been efforts in recent years to get this passed and undo this mandatory suspension. The problem is there's a lot of money in this, right? Again, you get $10,000 bills and things like that. I think there's some collection services that get some of this money, some courts that get some of this money. So there's a lot behind this, but we'll see. Again, it'll take some legislative action regardless of what happens with the lawsuit to move this forward.
There is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke points. If you like long hours in cold weather, the Washington Department of Transportation has an opportunity for you. It is in great need of winter maintenance workers. And Chris is here to tell us just what that involves.
Yep. The state usually hires temporary workers to augment their staff during the winter, and we really don't hear much about it. But the Department of Transportation is really doing a hiring push this year. The DOT's Mike Allende says it takes a certain kind of person to do the work.
It's a great position for people who have the experience, who like being out in the elements, who like being out in the outdoors and helping people.
Allende says every corner of the state needs some help to make sure that the roads stay open and safe.
We have needs all over the place, and it's not just snow and ice. You know, we got wind, and we got, as we saw this weekend, rain and thunder that can clog up, you know, catch basins and that kind of thing across our highways, so we need people to help us take care of those as well.
But it is the snow plowing, the de-icing, the snow blowing, and the other hard, cold weather work that can really use some bodies.
We need people who already have a commercial driver's license, because they're going to be operating our snow plows, bulldozers, snow blowers. So a CDL is going to be a big one, but we want people who have some experience working out on the highways, whether that's in construction, landscaping, forestry, that kind of thing.
You might have to do some minor equipment maintenance, repair guardrails or catch basins, or provide traffic control. You'd likely have to be on call too, ready to respond at a moment's notice.
People who are comfortable dealing with the public, because you may be providing help, traffic control at crash sites, work zones, that kind of thing. You may be needing to help and interact with the public. So if you are comfortable doing that, That's going to help as well.
People with first aid experience are also in high demand. Now, the one job requirement that I know that I am qualified for here is you must be able to sit or stand for long periods of time.
Some of these hours can be pretty long. When you're driving a snowplow, they don't go very fast. So you're going to be sitting for a while. You may be standing doing traffic control at a collision scene up on some foamy pass that could be there for who knows how long. As long as you're in some decent physical shape, you should be okay with that.
And obviously have some really, really, really good cold weather gear to wear. Some of these jobs have seen advertised for $18 to $27 an hour. Some are full-time, some are part-time, some are just on call. You can find a link to the job postings at mynorthwest.com. And I can tell you from experience that you need to be very comfortable being exposed on the roadway with cars whizzing by. If you've never stood along an active freeway, it can be more than a little unnerving. So you better have a little bit of fortitude on that one as well. The jobs usually last between 3 and 6 months. So if you're interested, it might be a good way to augment the income. But they're looking for people.
I've had a flat on the Mercer Island Floating Bridge and in the express lanes of the Ship Canal Bridge. So I certainly know that feeling of traffic whizzing by.
Oh, yeah.
But are you looking for a side hustle or something?
No.
It sounded like you were getting ready to apply.
Well, I mean, as I said, the only thing that I think I'm qualified to do is sit or stand for a long period of time. I don't have a CDL. I don't really have a lot of the... I mean, I've got the first aid training, but I'm not sure I would like standing doing traffic control in the middle of a blizzard on a closed I-90 over Snoqualmie Pass.
Sounds pretty exciting, though.
Sounds like your dream job, Sully, directing traffic. Don't lie.
Yeah, but not
when
it's
20. I know you too well to believe that.
Not when it's 23 degrees and the blowing wind. No, that for 8 hours sitting out there. No.
It's an entry level position. You start there. You build on that.
Yeah, well, there you go. That would augment my resume, yeah. Certainly.
From remote learning to mandatory sex education to closing the achievement gap, there's a lot at stake here in Washington State in the race for Superintendent of Public Instruction. And the two candidates took part in a debate last night hosted by the League of Women Voters. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott has the highlights on this race.
It's incumbent Chris Rakedahl.
I taught public school. I served on a public school board. I served in public higher education. I served in the legislature. I've been on an education foundation. So I've touched the system in so many ways. My own children are public school students, have been their whole lives.
Up against Maya Espinoza, an entrepreneur, mom, and music teacher.
I jumped into this race to reimagine an education system that works for all of our students. It's in my perspective that I think it's high time that we do something creative and imaginative and, you know, transformative in our education system.
During last night's League of Women Voters debate, one of the first top issues was COVID-19 and what's happening with kids and parents as a result of most schools in the state still working with remote learning models and no end in sight. From State Superintendent Chris Rakedahl.
So what we do at OSPI is we try to create very clear guidance, which we have done on both how to reopen, how to determine as a community when it's safe to reopen. And we don't do that by ourselves, of course. That's in partnership with the Department of Health and Labor and Industries. And then we try to tear down some barriers, try to add flexibility so that districts can really optimize their resources and build out a system consistent with the health framework. You're seeing more and more school districts open up now as their case counts come down, but it really is a function of all of us working together here. I've talked to my colleagues across the country that opened quickly in Georgia and Oklahoma and other places, and they're already shutting down in communities because they didn't put those safe protocols in place.
Espinoza, though, takes issue with the big picture.
Women and communities of color are paying the highest price. Single moms are paying an even higher price with their kids having to be at home, sometimes alone, and being required to do online schooling. I've said that school closures are an assault on working families. And this is if you have two parents, if you're lucky enough to have both parents. We hear that, you know, people have lost their job during this time, but unfortunately, it is women that routinely are the ones that are staying home because of school closures. They're the ones that, you know, statistically are the ones taking the child to the doctor or the dentist or the ones staying home if they're sick. Well, right now, they're the ones that are staying home from work, leaving their careers.
Her plan?
If elected, the first thing that I'll be doing is working with local school districts on the ground that are ready to reopen.
Rakedahl points to all he and the state have done to level the technology playing field.
Massive lack of technology, so we deployed more than 300,000 devices. a big lack of connectivity, even in some communities that have access to it, but they don't have the resources. So we've had 60,000 more families get connection to high-speed internet, fixed line and wireless. We've got federal dollars that I'm deploying to connect about 60,000 more.
The candidates were also asked what they would do to combat racism in schools.
Well, my slogan has been, you know, education funding belongs to the student, not a system. The way that we defeat systemic racism in education is by providing school choice. And I don't mean this just to mean your neighborhood school, but I want to see more options in education altogether. And I think that is something that the superintendent and I agree on.
From Superintendent Rachel.
So it's a matter of whole community investments. There are a lot of folks who say if you just give students a check and let them go wherever they want, that they get a better outcome. None of the research proves that. The poorest performing school systems in the country consistently, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, South Carolina, four of the top users of these private voucher systems. I like choice within an accountable public school system, but I also like more community investment. So you do have to offer additional supports in early learning to really get students ready for kindergarten. You've got to put in additional reading supports. You've got to double down on the programs of equity, like the learning assistance program that really is driving dollars into low-income communities.
And of course, the other major issue surrounds the mandatory sex education curriculum that was championed by Rachel.
We have 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 6 boys through our Healthy Youth Survey who report to us that they are victims of sexual abuse, a sexual assault or sexual violence or unwanted touching by the time they graduate from our system. We have a public health crisis here. And you match that, of course, with supports on the legal side, but also education. That is ultimately how you can help young people and help families and help communities. So this bill, like 29 other states, requires some form of sexual health education. Specifically, kindergarten through third grade is what's called social-emotional learning. It's actually a requirement in the bill. It came from Republican lawmakers that teaches things about keeping your hands to yourself and don't bully and how to control your emotions. And do you have somebody safe to talk to in case you feel uncomfortable about something?
But Espinoza has made clear her opposition to this is the reason that she even jumped into this race in the first place. And she fully supports repealing the mandate through Referendum 90.
When we talk about age appropriate, we know that we're really talking about grade appropriate and that the individual ages within each grade vary and the degree to which they are mature enough to handle sexual content also varies. With this being said, I am wondering if Superintendent Reichdahl has any concerns or is able to alleviate any concerns from parents who think that there are ethical considerations when a private organization who's also funding his campaign is supporting this bill.
Reichdahl holding no punches.
Again, this is a bill where the opposition to it, my opponent and her allies, have been very aggressive, and I give them credit for gathering signatures. That's the beauty of our civic system. But the dishonesty is remarkable. They grabbed a third-party book written by an author who attempts to supplement learning. If parents want to look up resources and work with their children on reproduction or puberty, they may do that. They grabbed images out of that third-party book, slapped it on something that looks like an OSPI letterhead, put it on Facebook, and said, this is what your children are going to be taught. It is dishonest, it is wrong, it is unethical.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com, an ice cream shop in Dallas. Howdy Homemade has been employing individuals with special needs. So when the shop fell on hard times during the pandemic, the community rallied around it. Tom Landis was inspired to open the shop back in 2015 after meeting one extraordinary young man.
It was a real busy night and I met Coleman and he just immediately jumped in and helped serve food and was super friendly. And I called his mom up the next day and said, hey, you know, I want to hire this guy. He has so much potential written all over him and leadership.
Coleman loves his job, too.
I was blessed that I was going to get this opportunity to not only be an employee for Tom, but to also be an asset to where Howdy's going to blossom.
Coleman's mom says having this job at the ice cream shop has made all the difference.
He has matured so much. He is so responsible now to know what time he needs to get ready so that we're ready to get him to work on time.
The Today Show says like many restaurants, Howdy's had to close at the start of the pandemic to ensure the safety of the employees. Coleman's mom says her son missed it a lot.
One of my greatest concerns was what Coleman was going to do with his time. He missed being at the shop. He missed the other employees. He missed the interaction with people.
But even after the shop opened again after 2 months, the slower customer traffic put it in real danger of having to close for good. Owner Tom says losing hope, though, wasn't an option.
I think it got to the point where it took absolutely a very clear message of me realizing, you know what, I can't do it. I honestly think that's when God said, what'd you say? He said, oh, you can't do it? Yep, no, you can't. But you know what? I'm going to surround you with a village of people.
That village of people included a friend who championed the shop from the beginning and organized a GoFundMe campaign that so far has raised more than $100,000 and has kept Howdy Homemade running.
We want to thank y'all from the bottom of our heart.
It's humbling. We have had multiple times where you just stop and you tear up because it's no longer our restaurant. It's truly the city of Dallas's restaurant.
The donations also allowed Tom to invest in an ice cream truck. Now Howdy Homemade is on the move, serving more areas and creating new jobs, of course.
These kids are an important part of our community, and that they really are helping and are a vital part of really all of our existence.
And the GoFundMe has been so successful. But on top of that, because this was featured on Today's show, a host of CNBC's The Prophet gave the ice cream shop a $50,000 grant, too. So they're doing well, despite the hardships through the pandemic.
Sounds like it'll be there a while. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon on Cairo Radio, here is C-SPAN fan G. Scott, who's been glued to the hearings this morning. So what did you think?
Oh, man, I'm upset.
Why?
I am so mad. Because here's the deal. The first time I really got into watching a hearing, I'm not going to lie to you guys, was about almost 30 years ago. It was when Anita Hill was letting the world know that Clarence Thomas was sexually harassing her. And so that was the first time in class. I was a freshman in high school. And I'm like, man, this is wild. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, wait, he still got on the Supreme Court? And then you know, a couple years ago or a year and a half ago, you had Brett Kavanaugh. You're like, whoa, you know, I drink more beer. And you have this situation, right? And then you're like, oh, this is a disaster. Then you have this. Look. Prior to what she stand for, what she's a part of, I have to say, guys, yo, this lady is like cool. Like she's humble, she's kind, like she's like, you know, I mean, it's whenever she says something, there's some things that I'm like, okay, I don't like that. That's kind of a non-answer. I didn't like the answer when she was talking about Roe v. Wade, or I didn't like the answer when they were asking her about if the president of the United States declares the election fraud or whatever. I didn't like those answers. But it's the most that I can say, like, this is a civil thing right here. And so she's going to pass. She's going to get in there. So there's that.
So you're looking more at demeanor this time around, or always when you're watching these hearings?
Yeah, it's just about the demeanor. Like, it's like, you know, look, if there's one thing I can say is this. If we disagree on something, that's cool. Matter of fact, in my family, our get-togethers, we always disagree on something, which makes our family get-togethers that much fun. But there's one thing that kind of stands out is respect. Like, I don't have a problem if we're going to disagree on things and we got another point of view. But when you start disrespect, then that's when the problem happens. Hence the reason why the first debate with President Trump and Biden was so terrible. Because it was just a lack of respect when you saw Vice President Pence and Senator Harris, when you saw them two, that was a debate. That was a debate in which we are used to, and was a debate, it had respect. Even though they disagreed, they had respect. It's kind of like attorneys battling against each other in our regular local courts. Those guys get in front of the judge, they battle, they go ahead, and they probably say some not so nice arguments against each other, and then after the court they go have coffee together. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I'm
that's
trying
what
to wrap
I saw
my head
today.
Around the idea, because she apparently reads the Constitution as is, in the time it was written, as it's meant. I'm trying to wrap my head around that, the inability to sort of evolve a document with the population.
And here's the thing, everything you're saying, Colleen, I'm with you. Right. I'm with you. I'm like, and she's like, well, you know, if that were to come across for me, I'd have to go ahead and get with my colleagues. Like, wait a minute. That's part of the Constitution. But I get that. But I'm just saying that she's going to go forward. There's not going to be a problem. Clarence Thomas got in. Brett Kavanaugh got in. She's getting in.
That is a safe bet. And G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock. I bet they talk about those long voting lines in Georgia, too, because that's amazing. Tuesday mornings, we go live to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold coming to us live and direct from the Washington Post. You've been watching the hearings at all this morning?
I have to say I have not. I followed them a little bit from our coverage, but I have not been watching. I don't find watching.
And I won't ask you what you think.
Yeah,
the consensus in our newsroom is okay. The consensus in our newsroom is that Judge Barrett is holding her own and is not coming across as some kind of fundamentalist monster. So it seems like it's going to be. It seems like it's going to be smooth sailing. To your latest piece on how much money the Trump family is making off the Secret Service, is it your feeling that this is enough? I mean, it's over $1 million apparently, just from the accommodations at his hotels when his kids visit these various places. Is it your feeling that this influences the president in some way?
Well, you know, there are ways in which people may try to use the president's business to influence him. But this is different. This is the president and his family using basically the presidency to enrich themselves. So there's no influence buying here. It's their influence over the government that brings money to their own property. So the story we have today is about Trump's kids. We knew Trump did that, but we didn't really know how much his kids had done it. His adult children, mm-hmm. basically, they go to Trump properties. They force the Secret Service to follow them because they have to follow them everywhere. And then they charge the Secret Service to be there. So they create a need for hotels that only their company can fill. And they've gotten at least $238,000 of taxpayer money transferred to the Trump Organization just by going to these properties and making the Secret Service come along.
I don't know if it's allowed for me to ask you about a competitor's story, but the New York Times just did a piece on the network of influencers that have been booking events like crazy at Trump's various facilities. And as somebody who's followed his finances for a long time, what do you think that story tells us?
Well, it was a great story. They got a lot of great details. I think that it shows that there's a lot of people who think there's an advantage to be gained by paying money to Trump's properties, people who want, mm-hmm. you know, any number of things from a train from L.A. to Las Vegas to approvals of different projects to, you know, they want their lobbying clients to succeed. And those people have held events at Trump's hotels and paid membership fees at Mar-a-Lago. One of the things about that story that I found a little frustrating was that sometimes they didn't really connect that paying of Trump's company to a successful policy outcome, or to say that right. the policy outcome that happened that wouldn't have happened otherwise. To me, one of the cleanest cases of this is something that we wrote about last year, which involves a Seattle company, T-Mobile. They signed an agreement to have a merger with Sprint, a huge merger that needs government approval and hadn't gotten approval under the Obama era. The day after they announced that merger, a whole bunch of T-Mobile executives show up at the Trump Hotel in D.C. for long stays, and they come back again and again and again. The CEO of T-Mobile even walks around the Trump Hotel lobby in magenta T-Mobile gear like a human billboard. Now, they got the approval they wanted. You can't say for sure that one led to the other, but it seemed like they thought they could gain an advantage by being visible customers of the Trump property.
Now, Trump supporters will look at this and say, you guys are just piling on Trump. The point of the New York Times story was, here's the new swamp, same as the old swamp. You know, here's a guy who came in and said, I'm going to drain the swamp. All he did was substitute a different one. Is that indeed what's happening?
I think that's right. And when people talk about the swamp before, I think they thought of, you know, what was being exchanged in return for political favors was campaign donations. And this Trump did change that in that he made it, you know, and now people are paying, in addition to campaign contributions, because he's still getting those, they're also paying his businesses so he can get a personal revenue out of it. So, yes, the influence buying doesn't seem to have stopped. It's just some of what they're spending on to try to buy that influence is things as Trump properties rather than just campaign contributions.
Yeah. And I will admit, I've been skeptical about this. As you know, every time you come up with a new story, I ask you, why are you doing this? You know, he's a billionaire. He doesn't need the money. Except now we know that he may, in fact, need the money based on the latest analysis of his finances, which indicate, and again, there's no definitive proof that's been disclosed. We're just taking the Times' word for it. They have accurate information. But it's indicating that he apparently is deeply in debt.
And many of his properties are losing money. He has loans coming due in the next few years that it seems like it's going to be hard to pay. You know, one of the things the Trump Organization and Eric Trump, President's son, have always said in response to our stories is Donald Trump loses a fortune being president. And, you know, one of the things about covering the Trumps is you have to be aware that sometimes they tell the truth. And I think this may be a case where he is losing a fortune, not on purpose. You know, I don't think he went into this knowing he was going to lose a fortune, but that's been the outcome. But to me, that's not a reason to say that the financial conflicts of interest don't matter or that payments to Trump properties don't matter. To me, they matter more. If Trump was rolling in the money and you know, could afford to lose a little business here and there, then it wouldn't matter so much who paid him. But if he's desperate for cash and needs cash in all these properties, then it seems like the value of each individual client, each individual payment is even greater than him.
Well, right. I mean, he's, you know, bottom line, he's in the hospitality industry and the whole industry is suffering because of the pandemic. So having nothing to do with what he may have lost because of the controversy regarding the Trump name, it's probably a pretty safe bet that those properties are suffering. Okay, so to the other part now, to the president back holding rallies and talking about how he feels more invulnerable than ever. We were discussing the various scenarios back when he first tested positive, but it sounds like scenario number two is playing out. He's using this to say, I got over the virus, so can you. And thanks to me, essentially, we've discovered a treatment that is very effective and basically, 7 days in the hospital and you're fine.
So that seems to be his argument, that he's gone back to basically denying that the coronavirus is a big deal, despite his own personal struggle with it. And you're right saying, well, you know, my recovery shows it's possible. I don't know if that's a great message, just because I feel like if you look at opinion polls, the rest of the country is still pretty worried about it and pretty aware that if they got sick, they would not get the treatment that Donald Trump did. Right. If I felt like if I got sick, I would get helicoptered to Walter Reed and I would get experimental drugs and, you know, round the clock care from the best doctors. I still wouldn't want COVID, but I'd feel more reassured if I got it. But that's, you know, that care is available to one person in this country, not to the rest of us.
Well, that's not what he said. But, okay, I'll take your word for it. I mean, he seemed to be very, very clear that other people should expect that level of care. Now, maybe his supporters don't take that seriously, but he seemed to genuinely want that. You don't think so?
I think he does want it, but that's what's maddening, I think, about doing this with 210,000 people already dead is like, wait, we have a treatment that works this well? Well, why hasn't everybody else been getting it? You know, if he's discovered that there's this cocktail that helps everybody get better so fast, you know, why doesn't everybody have it? Why didn't we get it before? And these are things that as the president, he has some influence over. And to just to say 210,000 deaths in, like, hey, we figured this out. You know, everybody's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. I think, you know, people aren't going to really believe that.
David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. Thank you, David. Have a good week.
Thank you, too. You can ring my bell.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. So many businesses are trying to figure out how they can cope with the new rules imposed by the whole COVID pandemic. Here's Cairo Radio's Rachel Bell.
Countless small businesses are struggling through the pandemic, but the nonprofit Work for Humanity can help. Right now, they're offering free business coaching to businesses with 20 employees or less.
Businesses often wait to get help until it's too late.
Seattle's Jen Gresham is the executive director and founder of Work for Humanity.
They wait until they have only a couple weeks left of cash flow. They're about to shut down, and we can't help businesses like that. And so really what we're trying to do is do these interventions for businesses who are still okay and have some time to get new programs out, new marketing efforts, develop new products and services, reach new audiences.
Jen says right now is a great time to work on your business, but you need to think of long-term solutions.
Many businesses felt like, look, just give me some cash so I can weather this storm. I just have to get through this, right? I just have to wait this out. And one of the big messages that we're trying to get out to people is that this level of change isn't going away. It's really urgent that we give people the mindset and the skill set to become more agile and adaptive, because that's going to be required from here on out if our businesses are going to make it.
The coaching they provide revolves around creativity, ingenuity, experimenting, and pivoting to a service that people want and can actually use right now.
This was not a client, but a great story to learn from. A friend of mine's daughter was a babysitter. Babysitting is pretty much dried up, but she needed to earn some money. So she decided to start dressing up like Elsa, because what she realized is that she wasn't in the business of just watching people's kids. She was in the business of delighting people's kids. So she would dress up like Elsa and drive by the house and just wave. The word spread, and she was getting all kinds of deals this way that earned her so much more than babysitting ever did.
Jen says it's about creating experiences, not just selling a product.
There's a small hotel in LA. It's kind of a dingy old hotel, but they are fully booked year round. And the reason is because they have this special thing where there's a white phone out by the pool, and you pick it up and you order a popsicle, and someone comes out dressed in a suit and with white gloves and delivers your popsicle. It's a silly thing, and it works.
Linwood's Carol Ann Lee co-owns Chef Dane Catering and the Here and There by Chef Dane food truck.
You know, I think our last large catering event was about the 10th of March. By mid-March, you know, we had no catering events.
When Carol Ann had a Zoom call with Jen and two of her colleagues for the coaching session, she was told that she's not a catering business. She's in the business of delighting people with food. So Carol Ann and her husband Dane started parking the food truck in neighborhoods, providing food for families instead of office workers in empty office buildings.
Looking at things like, you know, PTAs and school groups that might need support with school meal programs for families that are busy, and their philosophy and their questions were more not, what can we do to keep you open? It was, how capable are you and how much business can you handle? Because they saw so much potential. It just sort of gave me a little bit of spark.
That spark might be the most important part of the coaching. These business owners are exhausted. Many of them have laid off staff and they're doing the work themselves. They're scared and stressed, and it's hard to be creative and execute new plans when your head's not in the game.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, that's like 80%. Making good, sound business decisions and stuff is hard when you're so stressed and you can't think straight.
Carol Ann says she wishes she had asked for help way back before the pandemic so she could explore new business ideas. And Jen wants owners to stop focusing on trying to go back to the way things were, because she points out things weren't perfect then either. Owners were still exhausted. To make an appointment with Work for Humanity, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
To just start getting people to feel like they can do something, that they're not helpless. Things are not completely out of control. There are things that they can be doing.
It's a great idea, and it indicates that businesses need more than just an infusion of money to stay alive.
Exactly. And, you know, she does a lot with different restaurants, and everybody, you know, if every paper has been writing about Canlis, which is arguably the fanciest restaurant in Seattle, yeah, because they have been so inventive during the pandemic. And that's kind of what it all comes down to, is if you're a good business person or if you're a good cook, now you have to be more than that. Now you have to be an idea person, because Canlis has sold out every meal because they do fun things like online bingo. They do theme nights. They did a drive-in movie night. You know, when you get your food delivered, it comes with a rose and then a link to watch their piano player playing, you know, all these kinds of things. I mean, I get emails all the time from restaurants. There's Jack's Barbecue. They're now doing cooking classes virtually, which you can make quite a bit of money doing that. So yeah, you kind of can't stick to the old model if you want to make the same amount of money.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.